You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this event, the Hollowing Out of Japan, Myths, Facts, and Countermeasures. I'm Mireya Solis, Senior Fellow and the Knight Chair in Japan Studies here at Brookings. And I just want to introduce the event, tell you what are some of the questions that are behind this event today. And as you probably know, this concern that Japan's manufacturing base may become hollow as Japanese companies ship their production facilities, their production operations overseas, is certainly not new. This issue of hollowing out, kudoka, has been discussed in Japan for many years. But it does seem that there is now added urgency. This topic has come back with a great resurgence. And people are now talking about the many great disadvantages to domestic manufacture in Japan. And they feel, therefore, that this topic has become far more pressing. So what are these adverse factors, these disadvantages that people bring up when they think about why it may be hard for Japan to keep a very robust manufacturing base domestically? Different things come to mind. For example, a skyrocketing energy import bill, and quite frankly, uncertainty about the supply of electricity in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear accident. Also, the high value of the yen. And we know, of course, that there has been remarkable movement on that front, but that doesn't mean that that issue is over, because we don't know what will be the long-term value of the currency. But in the past, many Japanese companies have felt great pressure in their exporting capabilities because of the high value of the yen. Another issue that is frequently mentioned as hindering the competitiveness of Japanese businesses is overregulation. And I think it's really interesting to note, for example, that last fall, the International Financial Corporation in the World Bank Group released its survey, Ease of Doing Business. And basically, Japan slid in this ranking. It occupies now position 24th. And what these measures really is how much overregulation is constraining the activities of companies and manufacturers in Japan. Other constraints frequently mentioned are rigid labor markets, high corporate taxes, delay in signing free trade agreements, deflation, and the expected contraction of the domestic market as the Japanese population decreases in size because of demographic trends. So it's a list of, you know, very significant disadvantages that people bring forward to say why this may actually compromise the ability to maintain a robust manufacturing base in Japan. So the purpose of this seminar is really to address what I think are four fundamental questions. One is, to what extent are these fears of hollowing out warranted? Is this a real phenomenon or not? And what is the impact of these so-called push factors that I have just mentioned in encouraging the exit of Japanese companies away from the Japanese market? Two, what is the extent of internationalization of Japanese business? And should we think of domestic manufacture and foreign production as substitutes or complements? That's a very important thing that we need to establish. Third, what are some possible countermeasures to strengthen the domestic manufacturing base in terms of deregulation, promotion of inward direct investment, and encouragement of innovation? And fourth, and this is the big picture question, obviously a very challenging one, what can we expect will be the future of Japan's economy? What shape, what structure? Will Japan move towards a post-industrial economy mostly around the service sector, or will it retain a very robust, high-end manufacturing capability at home? Now, these are very important topics, and we decided to divide the analysis, the discussion, in two different panels. The first panel is called the Hollowing Out Debate, Domestic Constraints and Overseas Relocation. And I have asked the panelists to address a number of issues in this first panel. First of all, how should we understand the phenomenon of hollowing out? What is it exactly? How do we measure it? What produces it? Second, to what extent are these negative factors that I mentioned compromising the competitiveness of Japanese domestic manufacture? Third, is hollowing out a myth. Are Japanese companies really abandoning domestic manufacture because they are exiting, because they're going overseas in their production strategies? And four, how are Japanese companies navigating the disadvantages of domestic manufacture as well as the risks of foreign production? It's not easy either to undertake foreign production. So how do they navigate these different challenges? And I think we're very fortunate that we have a terrific number of panelists to address these different issues. I'm going to introduce them very briefly because we have also prepared their full bios, their copies of their bios, and I would encourage you to pick a copy of those so you can see really how talented and remarkable are the panelists that we have the good fortune to be here today. So in this panel, we have Barry Bosworth, who's Senior Fellow in the Economic Studies Program at Brookings, Tsunehiko Yanagihara, Senior Vice President and General Manager of Mitsubishi International Corporation, the Washington office, Tomohiko Inui, Professor in the College of Economics at Nihon University in Japan, Chuck Ernst, Chief Engineer at Honda's North America Engineering Center, and Jim Fathery, President of the U.S.-Japan Business Council and Senior Director for Japan and Korea in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And Mr. Fathery will act as a discussant for this panel. Now, I know I'm being very unfair because I have laid so many issues for the panelists and given them each 10 to 12 minutes address these topics. And you will see Jennifer is going to be in charge of keeping track of time. I avoided that task. And when you see her raise her hand or show you a piece of paper, that means you have 1 minute left, and then the second time it's time to please wrap up. So thank you so much. And Barry, if you want to get a start, that'd be great.
Thank you. This was a rather long list of questions she started with. And so to try to save some time, I prepared a handout, which you could pick up and back, I think. Well, most people have it. Sort of more with background information. And I hope it allows me to be brief about this. I'll start with a few general observations. First of all, I think that what's going on in Japan is of great interest at the present time here in the United States. And the major reason is because we face a lot of exactly the same challenges. The two countries look surprisingly similar. Number one, monetary policy is exhausted as a tool in both countries. Interest rates are zero. Both countries have experimented with quantitative easing, and it really hasn't done much. Both of us have huge degrees of fiscal stimulus, which have left us with very large budget deficits. And I think the third one is both of us seem to have completely dysfunctional political systems. So there are a lot of comparisons, and I think the worries that we have in both countries is that these difficulties are going to push us in the direction of stagnation with respect to economic growth. And so because Japan preceded us with a lot of these issues, I always thought it was interesting to focus on Japan to get some clues as to how the United States might evolve. But there is, I think, in one area, at least here in the United States, a perception that Japan has done a lot worse than it has. And I think it frequently gets overstated. The Japanese economy has actually performed quite well compared to other G7 countries. It's performed badly if you compare it against itself. Economic growth has drastically slowed down since the 1980s, but the growth rate in Japan is almost exactly the same as the growth rate here in the United States. How did Japan manage this dramatic slowing of economic growth without a lot of disruption? Basically by cutting the work week dramatically. When I first went to Japan, I couldn't believe the number of hours that, I guess I wouldn't say people worked, I would say people reported for work. Because I was in the Ministry of Finance and I didn't think they were working all those times, but they were certainly there a lot, right? And Japan used to have, by far in the OECD, the largest number of hours per year of any country. Today, it's almost exactly the same as United States. So Japan adjusted, particularly during the 1990s and the first part of this last decade, by cutting the work week as a means of, in effect, spreading the adjustment over time. I think it was really quite successful. Productivity growth in Japan's been almost the same as here in the United States. There's no real significant difference between the two countries in that regard. But where Japan stands out and differs from the United States, particularly going forward, is it has a dramatically shrinking labor force. We like to talk about economic growth in terms of increases in the labor force each year of, say, like 1 to 1.5%, and then improvement in productivity. Japan starts with an improvement in productivity of 1, 1.5% maybe, then starts subtracting off because labor force growth is negative. So I think the future growth of Japan, realistically, is about 1.5% a year going forward. And that's going to be composed of labor productivity of about 2% a year, which will be equal to the United States, but the labor force will shrink at about 0.5% per year, leaving you with a net growth rate of about 1.5%. This implies for Japan, because of the speed with which the country is aging, a major increase in economic burden about how it's going to provide for an aging population. Japan is going to be aging much more rapidly than the United States does. This is a problem that for us is still like 20 years in the future. And in part because of that and the slow rate of growth of the labor force, Japanese companies are going to have to move abroad in the search for workers, given the policies that Japan has inside. I think the major surprise from outside when you follow Japan economy, though, what stands out about it is the complete collapse of savings and investment in Japan. We have decades talked about Americans don't save very much and Americans don't invest very much. Japan was always known as a high-saving, high-investment country. It has transformed itself in 20 years into a low-saving, low-investment country. Household savings rate in Japan is now below that of the United States. Japanese save even less than we do. The savings that takes place in Japan takes place in the corporate sector, which makes very good rates of return, but then just hoards the money and has piled up huge financial reserves. Savings is very high, but corporate investment is extremely low. The government then turns around and borrows all that money from the corporations in order to spend it to finance this large budget deficit. So I think in the handout I tried to illustrate this, there's just been a revolution with respect to the savings investment balance in Japan. And from an economic point of view, I think that's the biggest macroeconomic event. But then to turn more specifically to these issues of competitiveness, in Asia, certainly Japan faces dramatic increase in competition, faces from China and from Korea. And I think the improvement in information technology that's taken place worldwide just makes it so much easier to outsource all that production. So Japan has been doing what the United States has been doing, moving its production facilities abroad. I think Japan tends to move its own facilities abroad. The United States just tends to abandon production, and we arrange with contractors to do it for us. So we have more of that model, I think, for the U.S. would be Apple Computer, that doesn't own a single factory in the United States or abroad. It's not even a manufacturing firm anymore. The other aspect, I think, is that without immigration, capital and management skills have no choice in Japan except to move abroad. And I think that's the major driving force behind it. Japanese companies, I think, will continue to be global leaders, but they'll be doing more and more of the production overseas, outside Japan. It's just an inevitable aspect of the demographic changes that occurred. Other one to remember is Japan's got an extraordinary external balance. Remember that Japan is the world's largest creditor nation. We always hear about all the reserves that China has piled up, but Japan's far ahead of China. It has very large financial reserves and investments abroad. And as a result of that, it earns a very large net return on its foreign overseas investments. And so it gets a lot of factor income comes in from those overseas. In the last couple of years, the trade deficit or trade balance has declined to about zero, mainly because of the tsunami, the global recession. It's hard to say exactly where it's going in the future. But regardless of that, China's got a surplus just from this capital income pouring into the country every year, return on their investments of about 2.5% to 3%, and that will probably grow as world interest rates recover. So I think it starts with a pretty strong external position. Contrast that with the United States, which is the world's largest debtor nation by a very large margin. The two countries on the opposite side. Deindustrialization, declining share of manufacturing, that has definitely occurred in Japan, but I would only point out it's inevitable. It's occurred in every single major country in the world. Once your income reaches a certain level, you're going to see your manufacturing share go down. And the fundamental reason is productivity in the manufacturing sector is faster than it is in the rest of the economy. So to produce the same share of GDP, you need a smaller share of the workforce. And that's what's happened in the United States. That's what's happened in Japan. And Japan is right in the middle of the pack. It's equal to the rate of of employment share, decline in the employment share in Japan is exactly equal to the G7 average. But it starts with a somewhat higher share of GDP in manufacturing. So it's still a relatively large manufacturing company or country, but it's experiencing the same pattern as we see in the rest of the world when people talk about the reduced importance of employment. The share of employment in the total economy in 2001 was about 20%. Today it's about 17%. You compare that to a G7 average of about 17%, it's come down to 13%. So nothing very dramatic. The second one, as we always hear about, is Japan's has suffered from changes in the exchange rate and particularly large appreciations of the exchange rate. And what has always bothered me, instead of ever talking about exchange rates on a multilateral basis, people want to talk on a bilateral basis. And you have to look at, I think, multilateral, and you have to look at it in real terms, not nominal terms. Japan has an appreciating nominal exchange rate, a depreciating nominal exchange rate, but prices in Japan are falling compared to those of the rest of the world. So the only way to actually look at this is on a real exchange rate basis, and there Japan exchange rate has been drifting down on a trade-weighted real basis for over 15 years, rather continuously. Then when the financial crisis hit and Japanese citizens got a little worried about what was going on in the rest of the world, they tried to take their money back home, and for a period of time, the yen appreciated in real terms, but nothing particularly dramatic. It's in the same range that it was at the low point a couple of decades ago. So I don't think there's a real fundamental change in Japan's exchange rate at all. Its relative competitiveness in that regard is about the same as it was over the average of the last two decades. But now, what's come along, I guess what we'd call Abe economics, for lack of a better name, another round of huge fiscal stimulus in Japan of about $110 billion. I think a reasonable estimate of the effect that that's likely to have on the Japanese economy will lift the growth rate during that period by about 2.5%. Monetary policy, another round of stimulus. Somehow we've heard all that before. To me, it just gives you a big feeling of deja vu. We've been there before. We've heard it all before, and nothing has fundamentally changed. It has the same conflict that the United States has. You can't make up your mind whether you want to have economic recovery or balance the budget. So you flip back and forth between one and the other about every couple of years. And the U.S. has now started that same cycle that's been going on for 20 years in Japan. I think the other one to point is that none of these changes have fundamentally changed any of the economic challenges that Japan faces, because nothing is going to be done about trying to get rid of this dual economy of this super efficient export-orientated sectors and an inefficient domestic sectors. The domestic sectors are overregulated and protected against competition, and that seems to be continuing. And I think it also has no way of resolving this issue of this enormous accumulation of corporate savings that's not being channeled into productive investment. But I would argue that export promotion, then, is not a viable policy for Japan over the next few years. Japan has to inevitably broaden out its economic base, improve its service sector industries, and look forward to the future in which most of the jobs will be in the service sector, not in the goods-producing sector. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marianne Brookings, for allowing me to speak in front of so many of my colleagues and friends in D.C. today. I'll be using some slides to go through what Barry has put together, a very comprehensive view of what the Japanese situation is. Given that I have 12 minutes, I have 13 pages, so I'll go through rather quickly. First, I will just lay out what this hollowing out trend of Japan's manufacturing industry is about. And then I'll go through some of the push factors, some of which Barry has already mentioned, and they'll be discussed throughout today's discussion, I think. And then I would argue that in addition to the push factors that I'll be mentioning, there'll be a pull factor. In fact, push is rather sort of strange word. It feels like you are pushed out of Japan without your choice. But there are certain choices that companies are making, and that's like I like to argue. So what's happening with this hollowing of the Japan's manufacturing industry? If you look at the numbers, overseas production ratio of Japanese manufacturing companies is rising. If you look on the left side, the red in the middle is manufacturing total. From 1990s on, it's consistently on the increase side up to about 18.4%. Some of the industry that we call process types, on the bottom you see it's some of the machinery, electric appliances, and so transportation equipment, those are much higher in percentage in terms of the overseas production ratio. Overseas investment is growing due to emerging countries' high GDP growth and Japan's low GDP growth, and that's also a fact. That's something Barry has mentioned. If you look at the right-hand side of the chart, what you see is the blue, sort of light blue. In my case, it's light blue, but it's green, and that's green. I guess Brookings is a very green place. GDP is on the increase, that's emerging countries. But similarly, if you look at the overseas investment, which is the red, sort of the wide red lines, Japan's investment overseas is definitely on the increase side. And if you look at the bottom on the yellow, that's Japan's domestic investment. So as you can see, while the Japan's domestic investment is on the decrease side since the Lehman shock 2008, the Japan's overseas investment, while it has dropped at the Lehman shock, has again increased back again. And it's definitely taking on the similar pattern as the GDP of the growth of the emerging countries. And that's a very important fact. Despite relatively steady unemployment rate on the left, manufacturing employment is down. If you look on the left side, the file in the U.S. Election, we talked often about unemployment rate. Japan's sort of general trend on unemployment rate overall is about 5%. While this is a problem, though, is 15 to 24 years old is relatively high, about 10%. On the bottom, clearly labor force employed by sectors is changing. As Barry mentioned, the tertiary sector, service sector, is definitely on the increase to up to 70%. While in 1950s, many years ago, you had the agricultural sector, the primary sector, the green, topping at 39.8%. So there definitely this industrialization has taken that toll. And then the secondary sector manufacturing is on the middle side. Technical skills among new graduates are declining. This is the quality of the labor. That's another factor that's very important here. Declining while employees' age is rising. If you look on the right-hand side, while the specialized courses, that's the sort of the bar chart on the right-hand side, sort of the pinkish, you can see the consistent decline of the specialized course takers, while the general courses are peaking in the 90s, and then still relatively high. In other words, the younger people are taking much more general courses rather than specific technical or commercial courses. while on the bottom, aging employees in Japan, I'm also aging too, I'm about 50, the below 29-year-old is on the decline up to 15.7, similar to 1989. The above age, 55, is 22.1%, 25.2%. So what this shows is that while the younger people focusing less on focused technical skills and commercial skills, the people who have those of them, which are the elder people, are aging. So that's a combination of very important factors. So now going to the push factors. The first, we asked the Japanese companies what they are feeling as the products and the reason for why they are going overseas. And they said that the main factors being, first, the yen appreciation, which is uncontrollable in many ways, high labor costs, energy uncertainty, and corporate taxes. And this theme comes back over and over again. So first, yen appreciation. Steadily increasing yen value negatively impacts price competitiveness of Japanese exporting foreign markets. Well, while I say that most of our companies feel that yen appreciation, yen depreciation to be uncontrollable from business perspective, it does, in fact, affect our way of marketing and operation strategies. A rise in the exchange rate from 100 yen to 80, strengthening of yen, that's 20%, raises the price of car manufactured in Japan and exported to the U.S. For example, 20,000 car becomes 24,000. Although it's not instantaneous, that's an automatic sort of translation of what the value is when brought into the United States. So without your doing anything, just by virtue of exchange rate, that's the pricing all of a sudden becomes 20% up. And that hits you right away. So as you can see on the chart, there was a time when we had 250 yen per dollar. That's in the 80s. And then went down all the way to the 100 in 1995. And then went up again. And then went down, appreciated up to about 79.8 yen per dollar on the average of 2011. As of today, I think 93.4 yen as of this morning. So as you can see, the exchange rate has played out quite a huge impact on Japanese companies in many ways. The second issue is labor rigidity and high wages. This is very complicated because as the industrial nation grows, obviously the rise of the labor cost happens. If you look at this chart, and it's quite a busy chart on the left, this is hourly compensation costs in manufacturing sector in 2011. Norway and Switzerland, Belgium, Denmark being the very high labor cost nation. Japan, it's just above the United States at 35.71 in US dollar basis. And if you look at some of the where Japan is going to, for example, in the Asian nations like Singapore, Korea, and so forth, on the right-hand side, they are significantly lower than the Japanese labor costs. Naturally, again, if you just compare apple to apple labor costs, that has an impact on how we think about the cost structure. Another interesting is low mobility of labor market in Japan, and that has something to do with competitiveness too. While we always believed that having consistent labor force in one particular field was a strength in the Japanese companies, but now perhaps it's clear that some of the lack of mobility is triggering such an export of the skills to outside of Japan, for example. And if you look at the numbers, and it's interesting how this is measured, but I won't go into that. But if you compare to the U.S., about 126.2, that's the mobility rate. And Japan is about a fourth of that, 31.9. Germany, interestingly, is about double of Japan, at 60.2. Energy is uncertain. This has been discussed at Brookings as well, the post-Fukushima, the cost of Japanese energy. While Japan has long been highly dependent on energy imports, energy supplies have been further constrained by the shutdown of nuclear power plants, naturally. If you look at the chart on the left, and this was made in 2009, pre-Fukushima, but they had a two chart, blue being the, dependence of import without, with nuclear running, and 96 is the number that without nuclear. So only 4% is covered independently by the Japanese own supply being hydropower and some of geothermal. So basically, most of Japanese energy sources imported. And as a result, it's very high cost. If you look on the right-hand side, the chart shows that place like Denmark is very high, but Japan is the fourth highest. And the U.S. pretty much on the bottom of the chart, at blue. And I'm sure U.S. will be much lower in the long run because you're now having an energy revolution with shale gas and tight oil. Another factor, high taxes, and that does hit to the corporate net income. And if more you earn, more you hit, and therefore the tax does play a large role. High corporate taxes increase domestic production costs, especially companies to developing countries. And here, again, some of the interesting note, Germany used to be very high in terms of corporate tax structure, but they went down, I think, as a result of a number of measurements they have taken. And now under EU's, they are back to about 30%. Japan is at 39.5%. Then the market change. And that's naturally one of the issues that's always been talked about, domestic market shrinking as demographic trends progresses. If you look on the left side, population decline in Japan, it's about 120 million people today, and large number is 65+. And then in the middle, the sort of the purplish area is 15 to 64 who are really producing in industrial society. They're shrinking down. And under 14 is not also expanding. So you have a younger, shrinking younger generations, while you have a relatively thick layer of elder people who tend to live rather long, which is a good thing. But then again, they have to have some input into the economy. Finally, this is I brought this up because this does show some of the interesting example of what manufacturers and also trading companies like us have been struggling trying to reduce costs. It's a logistics cost. It may not be a large part of your cost structure in things, but even if it's 2-3%, it is a controllable factor. It's something you can choose to reduce by picking right partners, right ports. But what is this? In the circle is the cost of domestic land freight and export. When you try to export any products and you put in place in port and you place on the ship. Then if you dissect this land freight into some comparisons, well, Japan has this very relatively high toll, highway road toll fee, and that's about 100. If you compare that to USA, relatively almost zero. And China about 16, Korea 20. That's the toll fee differences. Even though toll fee may not be the large, it's a very small percentage of your product, but it does have some difference. And comparison container, if you're on the right-hand side, Japan is 100, Kaohsiung, that's Taiwan, and then Busan in Korea is about half. So this kind of a structural cost difference does play when you really are trying to squeeze some cost reduction in your process. And then I speak very briefly about the pull factor because it's an important factor. And the value of sales in overseas market is growing while profits are rising. So companies looking for higher sales and higher profits naturally look for markets where things are growing. And that's a very natural tendency. And there's nothing wrong, I believe, with that. If you look at the top chart and by trends in overseas, that's North America, Asia, and Europe, and the Asian portion, which is sort of black shadowed, is definitely increasing. If you look at the Asia alone on the right-hand side, China is definitely high up there, and you have ASEAN 4 and NIS 3. So naturally, Japanese companies are looking for higher revenue basis, and which you are gearing toward Asia, and that's obviously changed your manufacturing strategy as well. And if you look at the profit also on the bottom side, profit trends for overseas affiliates of Japanese companies are definitely on the increase too. So what I'm saying is if this is on decline and then you're trying to move away from Japan, you're making a huge mistake. But if the numbers are following exactly what your strategy of moving out of Japan is following, then you are still making the right choice. But there are differences between large and small companies, and that's a very interesting phenomenon. The overseas production ratio is higher for large companies compared to small and medium-sized company enterprises. Large companies, about 66%, they say they are doing overseas production, whereas the SMEs are 22%, you see. And no overseas production is large company 34%, SMEs 80%. So the key is when and how and whether these SMEs are moving out of Japan or not. That may become a big issue. And if you ask them what are the reasons for their overseas production by company size, the most important reason for moving or production overseas are different, and overseas market development is the most important factor for large firms, while low labor costs are most important for SMEs. So how the managers view the differences in why they are moving out is different, and obviously their risks are different too. So in sum, there are obviously these push and pull factors in play here, and I would definitely argue that while there are certain push factors that are placing companies in very difficult positions, but at the same time, growth in Asian market particularly are pulling some of these companies away from Japan as well. And also there are some differences in motivations and activities between large companies and small companies, which obviously we do have to look very carefully upon. Thank you very much.
So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is my great pleasure that I can have opportunity to discuss about the hollowing out is a myth or a fact. This is actually the title given for this discussion. And especially I'm involved in the project for the last 2 years at the research institute called Research Institute of Economy, Trade and Industry, which is one of the government-owned research institutes in Japan. And the central focus of this project is on the effect of Japanese firms' overseas activities on the domestic economy. Especially, I am the most interested in the how overseas activities affect the productivity of domestic firms. And in my talk, therefore, I would like to discuss the result drawn from our research project by comparing the result among the various countries. My presentation proceed as in the slide in front. I'm discussing about increasing overseas activities by Japanese firms. It is already discussed by the last presentation, but I will compare the overseas activity between Japan, U.S., and Germany. Then I'm going to discuss about the effect of Japanese firms' overseas activities on domestic economy performance, especially people very much interested in the labor market. So I will discuss about the effect of the labor market, then the investment, and lastly, I will discuss about how the overseas activity affects the productivity of Japanese economy. Then I will conclude, and then I would like to discuss the necessary research topics in order to understand fully about the effect of the overseas activities to the domestic economy. And then I will show differences might be necessary. So this is the outward FDI investment by U.S., Japan, and Germany. And the red bar shows the U.S., and the green bar is Japan, and blue bar is Germany. As you can clearly see, the Japan is actually increasing the FDI stock, but comparing to the other two countries, the stock is relatively small. And this is the which you have already seen from the last presentation. As you can see, we can see the clearly increasing trend of the overseas activity. For example, in case of the manufacturing industry, it decreased from 14% in 2001 to 80%. In 2010, but I compare this overseas production ratio with Germany and the U.S. and I cannot get the most recent data. But if I compare the overseas production ratio in 1994 in U.S. and Germany, and they are 26% and 23% respectively. So comparing to the, we have 80% in 2010, but Germany and the U.S. has already achieved more than 20% overseas production ratio in 1994. So we are still behind in the overseas activities comparing those two countries. Among the manufacturing industry, the transportation equipment industry is the highest overseas production ratio. It has already reached almost 40%. So then I would like to discuss about the effect of the overseas activity on the domestic market, domestic economy. The first, I would like to discuss about the effect of the labor market, and especially the effect of the number of employment. This is actually this is reprinted from the METI report. METI wrote a white paper on the examining about the effect of the overseas activity on domestic economy. And I just compare more countries like Japan, US, Germany, Korea, or other countries. But I just pick up two countries, Japan and Germany. And if you see that this is the number of employment, the blue line is the total employment of Japan in the right-hand side. And the green line is purple line is the manufacturing industry, and the green line is non-manufacturing industries. And as you can see, the total number of employment is decreasing in Japan. And this comes from the sharp decline in the number of employment in the manufacturing industries. But we have some increase in the non-manufacturing industry, but it is very slow. It is actually a very sharp contrast to the Germany. In Germany case, as you can see, that this is again the blue color is the auto industries. German industries increase total number of employment is increasing like this. But German also experienced the decline in the manufacturing industry like that purple line. But the difference is actually the non-manufacturing industry employment is increasing. So I think that as Barry pointed out in the first presentation, and the problem in Japan is that both countries experience deindustrialization, especially the manufacturing sector. But in case of Germany, the non-manufacturing industry absorbing the expanding and absorbing those employment. But in case of Japan, we have a very sluggish service industry, non-manufacturing industry, so they cannot fully absorb the employment in that sector. So this is one of the problems. But as you can see, we have both countries have a decline in the number of employment in the manufacturing industry, but we have to examine whether this comes from the overseas activity or not. So in order to do this, because just simple figure cannot tell anything, so we have to do an econometric analysis to whether the overseas activity reduce the number of employment in domestically. So actually, I reviewed many papers, and most of the previous empirical work show there is no very strong negative impact from the offshoring overseas activities of the parent employment. Especially this is a Harrison and McMillan is a very recent paper examining the effect of the overseas activity to the U.S. employment. And they actually find that sometimes they have the overseas activity has a kind of complementary effect to the number of employment in domestic. And total, they have there's small negative effect, but it's actually negligible. So the Harrison McMillan find out there is not very strong, weak, negative effect to the employment. And Wagner actually, he's also surveyed the studies about the relationship between the overseas activities, domestic number of employment, and he also could not find any strong negative effect on the employment. And also the other things, the Yamashita Fukuo, they examined the Japanese case, and they found a complementary effect of the overseas activity to the domestic employment. So different from the popular view, I think that most empirical study find out the overseas activity actually promote or at least not decrease the number of employment in domestically. But what other important issue is that domestic investment. This is again I reprinted from the METI report. Here we have, as we already seen in the previous papers, we have a declining trend in the domestic investment in Japan, and also some increasing trend in the overseas investment. In case of Germany, this is actually sharp contrast comparing to Japan again. Germany has a relatively large FDI, but they're actually increasing investment. So Japan seems to have some negative impact from the overseas investment to the domestic investment, but Germany does not have such experience. Again, this simple figure does not show the clear impact, so we have to see the more rigorous empirical result. And unfortunately, in this area, a number of empirical studies are very much quite limited. But we have some recent papers examining the impact of the overseas investment to the domestic investment. And DZ40 Heinz, this is an empirical paper using U.S. data. They actually find that the U.S. overseas investment is a complementary effect to the domestic investment. So both overseas investment and domestic investment increase in the case of U.S. multinational firms. On the other hand, the Berberos, Fukao, Ito, and Letelier, they did a similar empirical exercise using Japanese data. And in case of Japanese data, some presence of a negative effect of the domestic investment, in particular in case of low-wage seeking FDI. So if the Japanese firms make an investment in the China or other low-income countries, then the domestic investment have a negative impact from that investment. But I think this is the empirical studies are quite limited, so we should have more study on that area. And this is actually I'm very much interested in the effect on the productivity, because even we have the overseas investment may have a negative impact on the employment or investment, but maybe the overseas investment may have a positive impact of the productivity. So Hijan, Inui, and Todo examine the effect of the overseas investment to the productivity development, and we found out some positive effect, but it's limited. And also the other things we found is that there exists a productivity gap between the large and small firms among Japanese manufacturers, which is enlarging. So seems to the firm who can make overseas investment can increase the productivity, but the firm cannot make an investment, overseas investment, seems to the productivity is very much slowing down. And this is my empirical result, examining the catching up process of the firms, and we found out some negative impact to the small and low productivity firm from the overseas activities. And also we examined the plant survival, and we found out the import competition from especially the low-wage countries have some negative impact to both the high productivity firms and the low productivity firms, but the impact is much larger for the low productivity firms. So we found out no clear evidence of the negative effects on the domestic economic performance from firms' overseas activities, but globalization seems to have a negative impact only to the small and the low productivity firms in Japan. So I have some future research, but I'm sorry, I have no time. Time is run out. So I would like to discuss later about those things. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank Dr. Salas for the opportunity to speak in front of this group today. I'm representing Honda in this discussion, and I want to be very clear up front. You've heard from some good economic people. A lot of good information is shared. I'm learning something all afternoon today. I am not a policy expert either. I'm a manufacturing engineer, and I've been a manufacturing engineer for about 35 or 40 years. So last week, in his State of the Union address, President Obama proposed the creation of manufacturing hubs across the country in an effort to boost manufacturing in America. Without getting into the specifics of his policies and ideas or proposal, but as someone who spent the last 30-plus years dedicated to that effort, I'd like to think that we've established in Ohio something of a manufacturing hub. After all, what we started in Ohio 34 years ago has led directly to 9 major production facilities or operations in the states, including Alabama, Georgia, Indiana, North and South Carolina, as well as a few more operations that are on the way. Most of these plants were established, and some are currently led by Honda associates who got their start at one of our manufacturing operations in Ohio. Now, after 30 years of building cars in America, a milestone our Marysville auto plant reached last fall, our North American production and R&D operations are taking on lead roles in the launch of key global products or models like the next generation Civic. More on these details in just a moment. Viewed at a distance, this direction might seem to support the premise that investment and growth in the U.S. could weaken the industrial base in Japan. That, however, is not our experience. As I hope to explain today, our strength doesn't make their weakness. And even as we continue to grow and advance our capabilities in the U.S., Japan remains the critical base for our global R&D, purchasing, and production engineering capabilities. The reality is that we have an ambitious growth plan that will require strong contribution of all 6 regions of our global Honda operations. By the fiscal year ending March 31st of 2017, we're challenging to achieve global automobile sales of 6 million units. That's up from 4 million currently. Based on our philosophy of building products close to our customer base, which first led Honda to build products in America starting in 1979, each region will make major contributions with a focus on the unique needs of the local environment. Here in North America, with a new plant now under construction in Mexico, as well as expansions underway at our plants in Ohio, Indiana, and Alabama, we will increase capacity to more than 1.93 million units next year. This will represent almost a third of our challenging global sales target. But it's not in response to changing economic conditions. The truth is that we've been producing more than 80% of our products we sell here in the United States for a number of years. Today I work in the North American Engineering Center, which is based in the hub in Ohio that I described earlier. The center serves as something of a technical expert operation supporting all of our manufacturing facilities in North America, particularly as it relates to developing production technologies required to launch new products in our markets in our region. Our work there makes me think back to how dependent we were upon the Japanese engineers when our operations in Ohio were still relatively young. I joined Honda in 1985, as you can see, as we were constructing the Anna engine plant, which is now the highest volume engine factory within global Honda. I can still remember our project office in the old farmhouse that's illustrated here, on land that Honda had purchased to build the plant upon. Each room was devoted to a different area of the plant, if you can believe it. The drafting tables were common use to everybody. We didn't have PCs or computers at the time. Each room was devoted to a different area of the construction project team. For instance, drafting tables in the living room were common for everybody to use. The facilities engineers occupied the kitchen because they got there first. Each bedroom housed different departments, assembly, machining, casting, and quality, and so on. Sometimes we had to dodge livestock as we moved back and forth from the construction site to our project office. We welcomed a number of Japanese engineers to our team in Ohio. I also did training in Japan, and this was true for many, many associates at the time, because we had no facilities to work within. We were not only learning the basic skills of manufacturing and how to achieve Honda's high quality levels, we were also learning about Honda's corporate culture and the way they do business. These Japanese engineers were our mentors, our trainers, our coworkers, and some of them became our friends. It was an extraordinarily valuable relationship, particularly for me. And I like to think that the role we are now playing is paying off on their investment in us back then. Now, American engineers like me serve as trainers and mentors ourselves. For instance, about 15 years ago in Ohio, in the year 2000, I was asked to move from Columbus area to Alabama to help construct and bring to mass production an all-new automobile and engine production facility on 1,500 acres. And many of the experts working with me to develop our new team in Alabama and to build our business there were also experienced Honda associates from Ohio. We followed a very similar approach with our auto plant in Indiana that recently opened 4 years ago and a transmission plant in Georgia as well. This kind of organic growth has been key to our success, and it has led to increasing responsibilities. Last year, we announced a new role for Honda in North America that calls on our associates to play an unprecedented role for international automaker. We will have the lead responsibility for developing processes to build key global models, then taking that production know-how and transitioning it to other plants throughout the world. To give you an understanding of what that means, historically, our production associates in North America went to our global new model center in Tochigi, Japan, to learn how to launch and build new models. Along with the associates from other Honda facilities, they would then gain the know-how and refine the processes used to build products in their plants, in their regions. Now more of this activity will occur in North America. Further, our U.S. R&D operations are taking on increased responsibilities for our global six-region operations. And they take even focus on two things, optimizing the needs of our customers into the product design, and they need to take even more active role in working with our local parts supply chain. We already developed the majority of our light truck models here in the U.S., Now, our U.S. organization for R&D is leading the development of both the next-generation Honda Civic, which is a global model in North America, as well as the Acura NSX sports car. Certainly, this evolutionary growth of our production and R&D operations in North America and in other regions around the world means a changing role for Honda in Japan. For one thing, our auto plants there are being reoriented around local market needs themselves, such as mini cars like our popular N-Box series that was introduced last year. But Japan continues to serve as the technical hub for new technologies. Honda R&D in Japan is home for our core powertrain technologies, as well as our advanced electromotive technologies for hybrid, fuel cell, and battery electric vehicles. Japan is also key to advancing new production technologies. The new Yori plant in Japan will begin production this year and is leading the establishment of more efficient and more effective and environmentally responsible production technologies. These systems will then evolve to other Honda plants around the world, including the new Honda plant in Mexico that will come online next year. This is the key to increasing sales of small cars that is so critical to our global sales growth. So the creativity and ingenuity of the Honda R&D, purchasing operations, and production engineering in Japan has never been tasked with greater responsibilities. At the same time, in the face of new safety and fuel economy regulations, the hyper-competitive marketplace, and Honda's continued growth in emerging markets, the larger role we are taking in North America is vitally necessary to the company. In that respect, we are smartly leveraging the investment in our people and our facilities in North America to increase our global competitiveness. The successful launch of the all-new 2013 Honda Accord is a good example. The Accord has been well received by our customers, And one of the key challenges was to achieve a big improvement in fuel economy while still meeting the needs of our customers for a car that is fun to drive. This required a new approach that includes the first direct fuel-injected engine that we've produced in America, along with a new CVT, or continuously variable transmission. We invested more than $120 million in Ohio, the transmission plant in Russell's Point, to add a new assembly line as well as aluminum casting, equipment, and processes and machining. In addition to producing the new four-cylinder engine at the engine plant where I got my start, invested almost $100 million to begin production this year of a high-tech pulley components for the CVT. CVTs have been criticized in the past for a rubber band feel that undermines sporty driving character, but our engineers in Japan developed a great new CVT transmission with a natural shift feel, and then collaborated closely with our transmission plant project members to enable us to assemble it well in Ohio. In the past, the durability and testing strategies were all developed in Japan, where the technical expertise was based. This time, instead of producing it in volume in Japan for 2 years and transferring it over to the U.S., they did testing on a mini line, and then they sent the mass production volume to the Russell's Point facility to start. It's amazing to me how quickly we can introduce those technologies in such a short amount of time and with such high quality. You will see more of this in the future, with Honda operations in regions around the world playing a more pivotal role. Yet, with the core competence of key areas, including powertrain and production engineering, remaining quite robust in Japan, and in fact, you'll see another example of this collaborative output this fall when we begin production of the Honda Accord Hybrid in Ohio. Like everyone else, we struggled during the global recession, and then we faced some additional challenges 2 years ago with the earthquake in Japan and flooding in Thailand. But we never stopped challenging to compete more effectively and to try and develop better efficiencies with our products and the methods that we use to build them. In fact, we used these challenges to get even better and even more competitive. Now, as customer and regulatory demands increase, and the competitiveness of the industry intensifies, automakers must be prepared to act with greater speed and efficiency to meet the challenges of the marketplace. But based on our longstanding approach to building products closer to the customer, our entire business model doesn't need change. Rather, our role in the U.S. will continue to grow and evolve through global teamwork that is a win-win for both sides of the ocean. So I'm excited about the new challenges and what that will mean in terms of greater opportunities for growth, greater personal responsibility and development for Honda engineers, both here in America as well as in Japan. Thank you for your attention this afternoon.
Hi. I now have the unenviable task of trying to summarize or comment on the previous presentations. The easy part is to say all of the panelists made excellent presentations. The other easiest part, and I could keep this short and simple, is just to say I agree. But I might elaborate a little bit more than that. So what I'm going to try to do is try to integrate a little bit of what they said, trying to artfully summarize their points, but also get to what I really want to say. So it's the balance between what they talked about and what I really want to say. So here we go. A couple of things. I would highlight maybe five major areas. First, Mr. Bosworth and others, I think, made really relevant points about the similarities between the United States and Japan in terms of our economic structure, our demographics, and some of the challenges that we face, particularly on the pension and the health care fronts. I particularly noted his comment about the comparability of political dysfunction in both countries. And I frequently joke with my Japanese friends that it's neck and neck in terms of whose politicians are the worst, theirs or ours, depending on the day or the week. That's still open for debate. But I think we both have big problems that our political leaders need to really grapple with in a mature way. At this point in time, Japanese politicians are coalescing around a new leader, and they've got some opportunities that I'll talk about in a minute. One thing I would note that I don't know that anybody really focused on was that in Japan, and indeed the case in the United States, in some manufacturing industries, there is just really overcapacity. And I think in Japan, particularly with the declining demographics, that's a problem. And you see it played out in the auto industry, but you see it played out in other industries. So the market solution for that sort of thing is consolidation and elimination of some of the excess capacity. That can often take forms that are politically and socially difficult. But I think those are some of the challenges that both countries have to deal with, but I'd say particularly Japan. A note on productivity, which Mr. Bosworth talked about, and it was touched on elsewhere. Japan is very, very productive in certain industries, particularly the automotive industry, which Mr. Ernst is a practitioner in. And I think that maybe helps drive up their overall productivity levels. I think if you look at some other non-auto manufacturing industries, productivity in Japan relative to the United States or Germany would be somewhat lower. And in that, I would mean like chemicals, some basic materials and things like that. So I think that's where they have some structural issues that could be addressed, which would help enhance productivity overall. I'll talk about that in a minute also. But I think particularly in services and agriculture, that's where Japan really does have problems with its overall productivity, and that bleeds into the economic growth. I agree with Mr. Bosworth. I mean, if you look at on a year-by-year basis, or if you look at a trend line over time, Japanese economic growth is not substantially worse than it is in the OECD or the G7 countries, but Japan has had more recessions than any other G7 economy, and that's because of export dependency and some other things that I think are problems that they need to get with. But I'm sort of the structural view that there are just some basic things that Japan can do that will help them endure these cycles, but also create opportunities for higher growth levels, maybe closer to potential going forward. I do want to make a positive comment. I think Mr. Bosworth and others talked about this. We talk a lot about the problems in Japan, but Japan is a big economy. It's a $5+ trillion economy. It's a rich society. And American companies with which I work in a range of industries still see Japan as a market with lots of opportunities. Now, there are problems. There's slow growth. There's things that could improve the environment. But it is still a top three market for many American multinationals, and that's both in terms of consumer products, agriculture, but also in the way that Americans find opportunities to partner with Japanese companies on technology. Japan's got a lot of technological capacity. It's got a highly educated and skilled population and workforce. So there are many, many advantages on which Japan can build if certain steps are taken, and I think that's the challenge for the new government. So to get to some of this, I think the problems that were referenced in all the presentations, I think that these are really solvable kinds of issues and solvable kinds of problems. They do require some political expertise. They do require some political will, or in some cases considerable political will. But again, this puts it back on the political dysfunction point that Mr. Bosworth raised, which is that at a certain point, the leaders have to step forward and do the things that are difficult because it's in the interest of the economy and it's in the interest of the citizens of the country. So I think that's really essential that go forward. So now where are we? Mr. Bosworth mentioned Abenomics. If you're not familiar with this term, the new prime minister in his second go-round, Shinzo Abe, from the Liberal Democratic Party of Japan, a term has been coined by one of his advisors, Abenomics. And in its essence, Abenomics is 3 points. It's a three-pronged integrated strategy. They talk about three arrows. The first is dramatic fiscal expansion. Mr. Bosworth said that's already been tried in Japan, and I would agree. Secondly, it's monetary expansion, and that's been tried pretty extensively, but I think Prime Minister Abe has a different expectation about amping that up in even a different level and maybe doing some things differently with the Bank of Japan in terms of purchases of long-term bonds versus short-term, and I won't get into all the weeds on that because it's pretty nuanced. But the third leg is what – or the third arrow really is what they call these structural measures or growth measures, and I think that's really where the proof is going to be in the delivery here, and I think that's really the critical element. So as I look at this, if you don't get the structural measures that change some of these things that all the panelists have talked about, we're just going to have another round of fiscal stimulus. It's going to drive up Japan's overall debt level. We'll get more monetary expansion. We don't really know the impact of the Fed's monetary easing longer term, and I think the same can be said in Japan, depending on how it goes. And so I think those are the dicey areas. What I would suggest is that what I would call the Abe opportunity is to use these dramatic measures to ease the transition to structural reforms in the economy that are going to help the longer-term growth profile or help the economy reach potential. Some of the things that I think are essential have been mentioned, but in my discussions with Japanese corporate people and you look around, you talk to government officials, they talk about the six handicaps or the six hurdles, and they've all been referenced today. I think Yanagihara-san did an excellent job of that. The yen appreciation, the lack of really strong trade agreements for Japan, both regionally in Asia but also globally, the high corporate tax rate, which on a statutory basis is the highest in the world. We're a very close and not enviable second. Burdensome and high cost of employment. And I think in some ways the way to think about that is it's difficult politically and socially. I grant that. But corporations hire because they have demand for their products or their services, but they also hire if it's relatively easy to do so. And in Japan, the work rules or the employment rules make it difficult for them to add long-term employment. And you have this perverse system now where a third of the workers in Japan are either part-time, temporary, or contract. And so that helps – not helps, that actually hurts because it keeps wage levels relatively low, and I think that's a problem for Japan in terms of low consumption levels and all kinds of things. You've got environmental regulations, which some consider pretty onerous relative to competitors, and then lastly is the energy situation, which everyone's talked about, and it's really critical that they figure out a way forward on the nuclear front in order to get a sufficient level of nuclear power. They're going to be importing more thermal fuels, particularly LNG or oil and gas, possibly from the United States, I should say, which is going to drive up their trade deficits. So you've got all those problems. In a couple of minutes, I would summarize a couple of structural reforms that I would hope the policymakers going forward will focus on. One is to open the economy further to trade and investment. And there I think the most significant thing that the Abe government can do is to make a firm commitment to Japan to participate in the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, highest possible standards in trade agreements, comprehensive terms. You have to include agriculture, not excluding anything. The trick here for the government in terms of the politics is to say, we understand that the tariffs on ag items don't go to zero tomorrow. You can negotiate that. So don't talk about exceptions before you enter a trade negotiation that you haven't been accepted into. But understand that you can negotiate longer phase-in periods for some of the sensitive ag items, and you can deal with your structural reforms in the ag sector at the same time. Secondly, Japan hasn't really attracted that much attention, but Japan has signed up to participate in the International Services Agreement. Which negotiations are going to go forward sometime later this year. That's very significant. 70% of the Japanese economy is services. It is a relatively inefficient part of the economy. So you can do things in the services agreement that can actually help the Japanese economy. The third thing I would emphasize is to increase foreign investment at 3.9% of GDP. The ratio in Japan is the lowest in all of the OECD. They have made efforts to increase incentives, but if you look at the incentives that are offered in Japan relative to those that are offered in Singapore, in Japan they're relatively short or temporary, and they're not even as high as they are available in other Asian markets. So Japan, given where it is, it needs to sort of go the extra mile and really do more to attract foreign investment. And the other part of that, which we could maybe talk about Q&A is changing the attitude towards inbound merger and acquisition activity. You don't see that in Japan at anywhere near the level that it probably should be given the size of the economy, and certainly relative to the amount of outbound M&A in which Japanese companies are acquiring U.S. or European or Asian companies. So there are some things that could be done in a friendly manner there that I think would help Japan. It would help foreign companies trying to do business in Japan. One other thing to open the economy is, and it's been alluded to in terms of global R&D operations, in terms of the globalization of the economy, Japan needs to get more engaged in the sort of open standards movement. And there's been tendency to want to develop Japan-specific standards because for years it had a large domestic economy. Now they need to learn to either accept or, you know, through mutual acceptance agreements or even work collectively with European and U.S. and Asian companies to develop common global standards. I think that would help Japan significantly. Regulatory reforms, those have been talked about. If you look at the WTO, the OECD, the IMF, Japanese government, they all say that there's too much regulation that hinders business flexibility. It hinders entry and exit from markets, et cetera, it drives up the compliance costs. Japanese companies agree, I think, in a very large degree with all of this, and so that's part of the burden that they face. Tax and financial reforms, lower the tax rates, increase the reliance on capital markets as opposed to a bank-centered financial system. Corporate governance, I think, is a key element here because in Japan you get lower returns on capital, whether you look at our return on investment or return on equity. There just needs to be higher performance requirements. Stop. Okay. I'm done. Labor markets and energy certainty are the other things that I would highlight as being some critical structural reforms. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Very rich presentations, a lot on the table. And before I open it to questions from the audience, I'm going to ask the panelists if they have any reactions to the comments from Mr. Fadri, but also to remind them that we have another panel that's going to look in much more detail at the issues of structural reform, foreign direct investment in Japan, innovation. So we don't want to reach into those presentations yet. But there's plenty to talk about regarding what are the strengths and weaknesses of the Japanese economy and how the foreign manufacturer and domestic manufacturer interact and so forth. So reactions from the panel to the comments from Mr. Fadri? I guess not. I guess I want to leave you all the time. I agree. All right. So now then the floor is open and we have some mics going around. And if you can raise your hand and when you get the mic, identify yourself and please keep your, comments short and most desirable are questions. Thank you very much. So who has a question? Right over there.
Good afternoon. My name is Jacob Vodder. I'm a master's student at Georgetown University, and my question is for Mr. Fadri. You mentioned that Japan should enter into negotiations for TPP and that they should do so not allowing, and that we should let them in without allowing any exceptions. I think that Prime Minister Abe at some point said that Japan wouldn't join if that was a requirement, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on allowing an exception for specifically rice. Rice alone, could we do that, and what are the dangers or benefits of doing that? Thank you.
How much time do we have? Here's the deal with TPP. It's a multinational, a multi-party negotiation, and you have to be granted the right to participate. But in order to do that, you have to sign up for the deal at the outset of the negotiations. And so it's not the United States only that determines whether or not Japan can participate. It's the other 11 partners now. And the condition that everybody, including Brunei and Vietnam and Mexico and Canada most recently, all signed up for was that It's a high-standard agreement, meaning it's going to cover substantially all trade in order to comply with WTO standards. It's comprehensive in nature because it's going to include goods, services, agriculture, investment. It's going to cover a range of what they call 21st century issues. Japan is focused only on the negative aspect of this, and they're focused only on the fact that, you know, over a period of 10 years they might have to lower rice tariffs or something. And I think what Japan needs to think about is the very substantial benefits to the Japanese economy. I think Yanagihara-san talked to, or someone talked about logistics costs. The logistics is one of the issues in TPP, or one of the areas in TPP where they're going to sort of integrate supply chains, and you'll harmonize customs rules and things. And that has immense value for Japanese manufacturers who are exporting to the United States or to the rest of Asia. Secondly, you get, you know, some commonality of standards and rules. And that doesn't mean that everybody's going to accept the U.S. standard, but it means that they're going to understand, all the parties understand, that Japan might have certain safety standards, United States might have certain safety standards, but they're going to recognize the processes, and so they're not going to make exclusions based on or exclude trade based on these differences. They'll try to work them out where they can. As to the specific point about rice, it's, you know, culturally sensitive. We understand that, but Japan has a 778% tariff on rice. There's got to be some way that can come down. And I think what's happened is that the main agricultural cooperative in Japan, the JA, has stirred up opposition, and they're talking about it's going to destroy Japanese agriculture, et cetera. Okay. A couple of facts. Japan currently produces only 40% of its food on a caloric basis now under the current system. So the current system is not working well. Average age of a farmer is almost 67. They're part-time. They farm the plots. They were small plots. They're not very efficient. That's difficult in the Japanese context, but it's all factual. And so what I hope that the new government will do, will figure out a way to solve that problem. It's a political problem. It's not a technical problem. So you can do that by providing direct income support to rice farmers. And you can condition it in ways that won't allow rice farmers who aren't serious rice farmers, like part-time weekend people, they shouldn't be eligible for subsidies, in my view. This is my personal opinion. That creates all kinds of distortions in the system. And I think you can change that. If you go to the Japanese people and you say, we have an opportunity here to reform our system so that we produce more of our food and you consumers will actually get food at a lower cost. Isn't that good? I think that's the kind of messaging that's not being done at all, because it's all being talked about in these very negative, destructive kind of terms, which I think are just factually incorrect.
Great. Yes, please.
I'm Barry Wood from RTHK in Hong Kong. I would like to ask about the impact of a cheaper yen on employment and investment in Japan, particularly, let's say, in the auto industry. When you gave all those figures, Mr. Ernst, about Japan still being the center, what has happened to Honda employment and production in Japan over the last few years, and how do you project that out?
I don't have all the facts and figures for that. My focus has been on primarily North America and my experience. I can tell you from my own personal experience working there and that we tend to work in the regions more and more than we did when I first joined Honda. And the reason we do is so that we can specifically zero in on the regional requirements and the new regulations, fuel economy, safety, and so forth, and then also to try and make sure that we're making products that the customers want. And what I see happening in Japan is that they tend to be more advanced in terms of what they're trying to do. You saw the numbers of sales from one of the previous charts, and they're decreasing over time. I think the products that they're selling are getting smaller. They're more fuel efficient. They emit less pollutants. And then for us, we try to look at how do you want to maximize your resource? So my experience has been that they tend to have a very good creative vein, if you will, for Honda in developing new product and more technical product. And that's how I see inside our company, that's how we're moving toward more technical product, more computer-driven controlled, electrically controlled type of devices. I can't speak for the sales side in Japan and what their strategy is. I know for each of the regions they're trying to grow. We talked a little bit about the global growth. We're trying to increase the volume of our global production using the regional units to try and do that. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but we're trying to focus on our global region and then utilize or leverage the investments that we have around the world to its best, our best advantage.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, on the way back. Thank you.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. My name is Kunio Kikuchi, and I think the main part is Mr. Bosworth's comments about the initial comments. I have some questions. Savings, for example. With very low interest rates, many people find it uninteresting to earn, to put money in the banks, and also that means people know how much money you have. So instead, I think there's a huge increase in home safes. And I'm wondering if a lot of the cash savings are now outside of the market. That is one point. The other, you have said that the service and retail industries are still backward. And during the past 10 years, I've been going to Japan three times a year, but lately I am very much impressed by the efficiency of the so-called convenience store chains, which I think, by comparison with what I see around the world, is the most advanced that one can imagine in terms of the way the shops are organized, cleanliness, service, and at night the clerks are Chinese. But that aspect, plus the domestic home delivery shipping services, what we call Takyu Bin, where people come and pick up your suitcase, deliver it to Tokyo from Osaka in one day for a mere price of $15. That is something I haven't seen anywhere else. So I'm wondering, perhaps those aspects might not have been caught in the statistics, and would appreciate your comment. Thank you.
You want to take that? Then I got a second.
Let me just go to the one of the data questions, if you like. I don't know that much about commenting on.
I don't think they can.
Convenience stores.
But the savings does capture. If people save in the form of paying off their mortgage, for example, and accumulating wealth inside their house, that's fine. That's caught in the national statistics. Think of savings as just being a measure of people's income minus their consumption. And in concept, all forms that savings takes gets included in the statistics. So there's nothing about investing in your home that in any way kind of unique. I would point out that home values have continued to decline in Japan, and investment in housing has continued to fall off. I believe it's now negative after adjusting for depreciation. So I don't think there's a big problem with the statistics, but I can't comment on the 7-Elevens.
Maybe I comment on 7-Eleven and Lawson, because Lawson is part of Mitsubishi. Mr. Kikuchi, the questioner, I think is very correct. I think many of us who are here, who have been to Japan, who have worked in Japan, feel that there's a somewhat of this discrepancy between what the macroeconomic factors and what we see to be some problems. When you're in Japan, you don't really feel that. In fact, you see much more efficiency, much more competition, much more improved society in some ways, not necessarily all. So what's that difference? I guess that's because, as I mentioned, there are companies, if let's assume if the national power, national level of strength is on decrease, and accordingly, if the companies also decline, then you don't have Japanese companies surviving anymore, correct? So in that sense, companies are struggling trying to survive in this environment through which they are gaining some competitive advantage, including things like Lawson and 7-Elevens. And they're very much aware of that. So what I'm saying is that while we always sort of look at and see there are a lot of factors that's pushing people out of Japan or the companies out of Japan, there are a lot of new things that are now nurtured through this downturn period, which to me is a very large potential. Not many people are looking at it. And that's why I think this week's Prime Minister Abe's visit is very interesting, because he may twist that view in that we may be able to take some of the things that are developing competitively among the Japanese companies to be exposed to this new environment when competition definitely is going on. So that's what I'm trying to say, is there's a sort of feeling gap of what we see versus what the numbers and then also the feeling from macroeconomic point of view are looking at it.
Thank you. Inoue-san? Yes.
So I'd like to discuss about the quality of the services. Actually, it's a very difficult question because usually we have to adjust the quality of the service between the countries, but it's quite difficult to adjust this. So statistically, it is very difficult to compare the productivity or efficiency of the service industry between U.S. and Japan. And the other thing I would like to mention that as I showed in the slide, the one important problem in Japan is the discrepancy of the productivity between the large farms and small farms. As you mentioned, we can find very efficient farms like 7-Eleven and Lawson. They are very efficient, I think, international comparable efficiency. But we also have a very small farms, very low competitive, low productivity in those farms, and they survive, and their share is still large in the economy. So in the aggregate level, we found that productivity is very low in the service sector. So this is actually the problem in Japan, I think.
Thank you. This gentleman here had his hand up.
Thank you. Interested in a quick poll of the panel, whether you think the logic of joining the TPP is beginning to gain momentum in relation to the political problems that might cause at home for Prime Minister Abe. And second, whether you have any insight into expected progress on this discussion at the summit Friday.
Jim?
I think it is gaining momentum. I think the Prime Minister seems personally committed to pursuing this. He's trying to work out the political dynamics of how this is going to unfold. I don't think he's going to announce tomorrow that Japan is going to join TPP. I have no idea. But, I think they're trying, and they're having an internal political debate, which is very important in Japan. And I think he and a number of his advisors see the value of having Japan participate in this agreement for the reasons that we've all talked about.
Okay. I think I saw their hands. Do you want to say something on this?
I think that naturally whether Prime Minister Abe at this point would commit, as of this week, is not known. And there's always we have been waiting for some time in the past prime ministerships. But I think that the timing is definitely coming too close to some of the decision-making in terms of what Japan needs to do, both from the fact that the negotiation is unrolling and that there has been so long of a waiting period for Japan to express that. So from my personal perspective, I think there is a opportunity now being risen at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Other questions in the back?
David Parker, I'm from American University. And we hear a lot about the kind of politics of monetary policy at the elite level, you know, what Abe wants versus Asa wants and kind of saying different things at the moment. But what about the kind of broader politics of inflation, given that there's really kind of a cross-generational impact mm-hmm. of it in terms of who's saved and who has debt, and also kind of the implications of potential inflation for Japan's national debt?
Very interesting. Who would like to take that one? Don't rush. No takers?
Well, I would say one is that Japan should be worrying about the interest rate implications that might go along with an increase in the inflation. Right now, interest on the debt is not a particular burden because the interest rate is essentially zero. One day, the global interest rates will change. I'm not going to give you a date. not that dumb. But I think you have to think that sooner or later, interest rates globally will go back up. And when you have a debt of the magnitude of Japan's, that's a serious issue. What will be the response to it, though, some people in Japan, businesses might like. I think if the burden gets too high, what happens? The yen will depreciate and fall because it will be too big a burden to pay. So usually you think that countries that become over-indebted are countries that suffer an exchange rate depreciation. And I guess there's some people in Japan who would think that that was a good thing because they could sell their products cheaper than otherwise would be the case. So it's going to have mixed effects across society about what happens as a consequence of it. But it should be a concern. This is a very unusual period, both in Japan and in the United States, and we don't think it can last forever.
Thank you, Barry. If I may ask a question, I would like to connect two running themes in this panel. One has to do with the dual economy in Japan, the fact that you have very large, highly competitive companies, but you also have the small and medium-sized companies. And the other theme, globalization. And I think that many of the panelists here identify the challenge that the smaller companies have in taking advantage of these opportunities, the so-called pull factors, and they may actually be facing many more constraints when we talk about the push factors. So I was wondering if you have any sort of prescriptions or ideas as to how you help these small and medium enterprises navigate better the challenge of globalization so they're not the ones that are being left out and they can also profit from these potential opportunities.
Well, I think that's a huge challenge for everyone. And in trade negotiations and trade agreements increasingly, and particularly in the TPP, they're talking a lot about how to help SMEs benefit from these agreements. And I think that's a really critical thing that governments have to think about. But I think it's very difficult in practice to actually do that because SMEs often are not the ones who are going to be actively looking for export markets. I mean, you can look at UPS and FedEx, mm-hmm. and they do these great studies where they figure out that an SME will export to one market, and then if you can get them to plus one or plus two, you know, it really helps them grow. The other way to think about it is that SMEs are actually suppliers to the large companies that are that will eventually or ultimately take advantage of the trade agreement itself. So there's a ripple effect there that I think is important. In Japan and a lot of other economies, you need to see probably consolidation in some instances mm-hmm. because you've got a lot of companies that are going to struggle, and if they don't have capital and if they don't have familiarity with information technology and if they can't compete in a global economy, that's a problem. But you know, if we believe in markets, they'll either sink or they will swim. So they have to take the challenge upon themselves in order to do that. But I think there are ways that the government and their larger ultimate customers can help them participate in these agreements in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, we may have time for one more question, if there's one. Professor Ata.
Urata from Waseda University. I have a question to Mr. Fazer regarding TPP. Rice has been attracting a lot of attention, but if I understand correctly, if Japan wants to come in, U.S. has to approve of it, and there are three conditions which are laid out. One is beef import, and the other is postal insurance, and then small car issues. How do you see the possibility of U.S. Congress accepting how do they deal with these three issues? Can Japan clear these three conditions? Or how do you see that? Maybe, from the auto industry, maybe you can make comments too about small car issues in Japan.
Uh, thanks for the question. It's a great question. I think Japan can easily meet the challenges. It's going to take some things that they will need to do. On the beef issue, they've already done it. They've agreed to the 30-month age standard as of February 1. So now 90-95% of U.S. beef exports will be able to enter the Japanese market. That's important primarily because U.S. senators and representatives in Congress from beef exporting states want to see that. And Senator Baucus from Montana is a big supporter of the Montana beef industry, but he's also someone who for 30 years or more has been involved in global trade negotiations from the U.S. perspective. He's very happy. So that's a good thing. On the insurance issue, this is often, I think, misunderstood in Japan. The question is not whether or not Japan Post is privatized or remains a public corporation. I think the issue is simply the competitive conditions that private competitors and Japan Post have to operate under. And the simple point is that there has to be a level competitive playing field with equal competitive conditions for both the private and the Japan Post insurance and banking entities. This is not just the U.S. view. This is a view that's shared by Japanese insurers and Japanese banks, but it's also shared by Canadian insurers and those from Australia and New Zealand who all agree to the same principle. So it's not just a U.S. condition. It's important in the U.S. consultative process with Japan, and I think there have been multiple rounds of negotiations that are probably going on at this very minute about that and the other issue. The auto issue is a very tricky issue, and it's a political issue more than anything else. And I don't really want to say too much about it other than that there have been ways to work around that problem. I would say one thing that complicates the dynamics right now, and this may be unpopular, but the Abe government's monetary expansion, even though they haven't actually materially done anything, it has weakened the yen. A weaker yen is only going to complicate the automotive parts of this discussion because of the ongoing and longtime concerns of the U.S. auto industry about perceived currency manipulation and such in Japan. But I still think it's a very solvable problem, and there just needs to be a way to a commitment, really, to think creatively and flexibly about how to address the problems perceived by the U.S. industry in a way that are consistent with the mandates of the agreement.
Great. We're almost out of time. I can spare like 1 minute if you want to ask your question super quickly. So I don't leave you. Just the mic is coming, and if you want to identify yourself, and then very concise answers, please.
Thomas Bailey from Perry Capital. Just a quick question on the yen weakness recently. A number of you cited the yen strength as a hurting Japanese competitiveness. How should we think about the yen's weakness also potentially raising energy prices? Mm-hmm. I know Mitsubishi Corporation imports a lot of coke and coal and iron ore and the like. That's going to have kind of higher kind of flow through costs to a bunch of Japanese industries. And also in the energy sector, if you turn off all the nukes, you're going to have to use more LNG and coal and the like to power Japanese industry. So how should we think about kind of the weaker yen actually having a kind of a negative flow through effect on Japanese competitiveness?
Great. Yanagihara-san.
Yeah, that's a very good question because in the Nikkei newspaper today, there was an issue about that this lower cost of importing of, for example, natural gas would do to electric costs, which has a certain link to the actual value of the import of the gas and oil and so forth. So while the price is on the increase side, people don't see that because there's a devaluation factor built into it. So that's correct that while there's a benefit of stronger yen in importing and weaker yen in terms of exporting. What the trade-off? I can't speak for all the companies, but some companies who are very much earning your profit outside of Japan, weaker yen brings, in the same dollar value, higher yen profit, right? So that in itself is a somewhat of a positive factor. So even though it's uncontrollable, a lot of companies who are export-driven 1 yen depreciation, for example, in the investor relation, there's a lot of things written over, could bring up to 10 to almost 100 million of dollars upward. So you will see over this quarter, a lot of Japanese companies who are much more export-driven would bring back some profit higher than what they had expected, probably. Simply not because they have done better, but simply because of exchange rate. So that's how that affects. But I agree with you, certain companies, when the import is major cost structure, that has a huge impact in terms of you negatively. But if it's an export-driven, and also you have much higher percentage earnings outside of Japan, consolidated into Tokyo, the depreciation yen helps. That's how it works.
Thank you very much. So we had a really fascinating discussion. It's time to take a break. We'll reconvene at 3:30, and I just want to tell you that in the second panel, we're going to discuss how do we fix what needs to be fixed in the Japanese economy, and what is a long-term future for Japan. So great topics, and in the meantime, please enjoy the refreshments, and please join me in thanking the panelists.